All right. As we indicated this morning in our introduction to Dr. Francisco, a fine lecture that got us off to a good start, owing to a false sense of liberality and of permissiveness in the choice of worship forms in our churches, the Psalms have been virtually eliminated from our present-day congregational worship, with the lamentable consequence that beyond a few old favorites like Psalm 23, the first Psalm, the 100th, the 150th, and a few others, you mention your favorite, a great host of worshipers are totally ignorant of their great hymnic heritage from the Old Testament scriptures. I cannot prove it. I hope I'm wrong. And if it is anybody in here who can correct me, I would be grateful. But I would venture the assertion that as a general rule, never before in the history of evangelical musical worship, or worship in general for that matter, has the Bible, and especially the Psalter, figured so unimportantly in the public devotion of the people of the congregation. The Bible was central in the worship of the earliest Christians, for indeed the Hebrew Psalter was the first book of Christian praise. The Psalms continued to be prominent in the musical devotions throughout the medieval period, especially in the daily hours of prayer. Witness the Vespers with which we're working. In the tumultuous Reformation era of the 16th century, psalmody in new and popular forms flourished throughout the Protestant Christian world. And even in the great evangelical revival of the 18th century, to which Dr. Husted referred this morning, great hymnists like Isaac Watts and Charles Wesley magnified the scriptures through biblical paraphrases and through great biblical hymns, which embodied not only the letter, but more importantly, the spirit of the Word of God. Today, in many of our churches, the Psalms have lost the place they once had, and we should not only face up to this disturbing development, but together resolve to do something about it. You will recall that in the churches of the Reformation, there were two main streams of church song, both of which were intimately connected to the Psalms. On the one hand, there was hymnody, human compositions for the praise of God and for the edification of men, with the great German reformer Martin Luther as its champion. On the other hand, there was metrical psalmody, with the eminent French theologian John Calvin as its proponent. Luther merely carried on the great tradition of the medieval Latin hymn that had been inaugurated by Ambrose of Milan back in the 4th century. It is quite important to note, however, that several of Luther's great and best-known hymns are founded upon the Psalms. Aus tiefer Not schrei ich zu dir. Out of the depths have I cried to thee, one of his original hymns, based, of course, upon Psalm 130. And then his greatest, A Mighty Fortress, is based on none other than Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Other great German hymnists, such as Philipp Nicolai and Joachim Neander, followed Luther in this practice of basing many of their hymns on the Psalms. But while their special contribution was original hymns and not metrical versions of the Psalter, we should be reminded on this, the 450th anniversary of the nailing of Luther's 95 Theses to the Wittenberg Castle church door, an event that is soon to be celebrated, is it not, throughout the Christian world, in fact, just next week, October 31. We should be reminded that by and large the great German hymns from the early Reformation period were solidly based on the Psalter. But the other great reformer, Calvin, gave his adherence to a tradition that had been unbroken since the primitive days of the church, when it had no other means than the Psalms in order to sing its praise. Separating more radically with the immediate past, worshiping the Bible almost as if it were a newfound book, venerating its very text with almost superstitious reverence, Calvin and his followers rejected original hymns altogether, treated the Hebrew Psalter as the only inspired manual of praise, and concentrated their efforts upon setting this in such a way that it could be sung by a congregation. Thus, the Psalms in metrical versions gained great dignity, great authority, not to say great popularity, by their exclusive use in the public worship of the Reformed churches. You will recall that this is psalmody of the very strictest sort. Exact metricization of the original, not deviating from it one jot or tittle, not adding to it, not interpreting it at all, but simply and often crudely rearranging the biblical words into patterns that would accommodate simple, measured tunes, such as a congregation, even an unlettered congregation, could sing easily. So that if the original psalm said, let's take Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. The metrical version would have to be almost in the very same language. The Lord's my shepherd, I'll not want. He makes me down to lie in pastures green. He leadeth me the quiet waters by. Simply a rearrangement of the biblical words into patterns that could accommodate a simple metrical tune. This mode of praise dominated the history of English hymnody for well over 200 years. And even today, it constitutes a large part of the congregational worship of many of the churches, particularly those of the Calvinian orbit. Now, these two streams, psalmody and hymnody, ran parallel until the 18th century, when Isaac Watts came on the scene, a man of such genius, such poetic fire, such great will, that he could achieve an amalgamation of this metrical psalm tradition with the sporadic attempts that had already been made in England toward an original hymnody, and thus to achieve the title of being the main begetter of the English hymn. As a first thought for restoring the Psalms to our Baptist musical worship, then, may I suggest that we hark back to the thought and work of this great hymnic giant of the 18th century, Isaac Watts, to see if his so-called system of praise may not be helpful and instructive for us in our situation. In essence, you who are presently in hymnology, and it seems like I almost have a hymnology class out here only in capsule from 1950 all the way up to 1967, you will recall that his great tenet with regard to the system of praise was essentially twofold. First, he said, rather than rejecting the Psalms, as we have tended to do, albeit unintentionally, let us renovate them. Rather than tossing out all this great body of devotional literature, he Christianized and modernized it. In other words, he brought the Psalter up to date, and he made its use relevant for the men and women in the pews of 18th century England, and of America, for that matter. In the second place, he successfully contended that a truly authentic hymnody for Christian folk had to go beyond the very words of Scripture to include original expressions of praise and devotion. But in carrying out this second tenet, he produced hymns which were models of fidelity to the Scripture. Now, it's with the first tenet that we are primarily concerned here. Let us invoke his spirit to encourage a reintroduction of the Psalter, or at least parts of it, into our congregational worship. But lest this be interpreted as a nostalgic nod to the past and to its outdated and long discarded forms, may I hasten to suggest that the Wattsian principle would require that our use of the Psalms be modernized and made relevant in style to the worshiper of this age. Now, there are at least two ways that a fresh approach can be made to the kind of restoration we are considering here. One would be a searching out of old treasures. Not only forgotten ones, but quite possibly treasures never known from the past and their creative application to present-day use. The other way would be the appropriation of entirely new styles and methods evolving out of compassionate contact with life in the contemporary world. With regard to the first of these ways, let us consider the possibilities of metrical psalmody for today's worship. In consideration of the second, on next Thursday at 8 o'clock, we shall take a look at the phenomena of Gelano psalmody. Now, the principle of innovation and relevancy is, to be sure, much older than Watts. Indeed, metrical psalmody is of particular attraction because it is a prime example of this principle at work back in the 16th century. Furthermore, Dr. Francisco reminded us this morning that this principle of change was not unknown even within the Hebrew Psalter itself. Although Calvin was the chief proponent of this metrical psalmody, it should be carefully observed that it had its origin in the court of Francis I of France, where the lords and the ladies were entertained by the fashionable versification of the psalms by the gay and debonair Clément Marot, the chief darling of the Parisian court. Furthermore, it should be noted that the tunes to which these Genevan psalms of Calvin were sung were cast in a musical idiom which was contemporary to that day. Metrical psalmody in its beginnings was not the exclusive province of a severe type of Calvinistic worship in church or cathedral, but actually was one of the chief pastimes of a rather gay and frivolous French society in court and castle. The melodies that Louis Bourgeois, the chief musical collaborator of Calvin, either invented or adapted for psalm singing in worship were in the nature of popular airs, which were sung by the masses in the fields at work and in the streets at leisure. Far from being staid and wooden, Geneva jigs, they were called. In derision, of course. They were not unlike the madrigals and the chansons, which were produced in such amazing quantity and variety during this exceedingly rich musical period of the Renaissance. These tunes possessed a rhythmic nimbleness, a grace, as well as a dignity and virility that has seldom been equaled in hymn music since. Indeed, these tunes may well have been as popular a form of public praise as Calvin could have laid his hands on in order to get the psalms sung in his congregation at Geneva. Now, let us be mindful of the fact that this is music almost at the opposite pole from that was being discussed before you ate lunch today. In the Renaissance, there were two distinct tendencies with regard to rhythm in music. First of all, there was this fluid rhythm, flowing, non-metered, in a contrapuntal texture, partaking of the style of Roman chant, such as we are considering in the Monteverdi Vespers. This is the kind of music of the motet, the mass, the vespers, and many other kinds, even in instrumental music. But on the other hand, there was a strongly marked rhythmic pattern in music, in a predominantly chordal texture, such as is found in instrumental dance pieces and in certain kinds of vocal music, usually secular. But the metrical psalm is an instance of the application of this principle even to sacred vocal music. It is one of the ironies of church music history that the most austere form of Protestant worship, namely Calvinism, should appropriate for its purposes the music that was the earmark of the gayest and freest form of French Catholic society. But that's exactly what happened in the 16th century. And the adaptation of this gracious and serene hymn music for divine service set a very noble standard for the psalm and hymn tunes that were to follow. It is music of such enduring dignity and admirable congregational quality that it commends itself highly to present-day usage. Now, would you take into your hand, if you have it, the 14 psalm settings from the early Reformed Church in Scotland. And I'm going to enlist the aid of Mr. Max Pugh at the keyboard, in which we're going to begin to look at a few, and in order to keep you from going to sleep, I'm going to ask that you participate in some of the singing as we go along in our demonstration. Louis Bourgeois, the composer of most of these tunes, has the distinction of being the chief architect of the modern hymn tune by virtue of these graceful, sturdy tunes which he prepared for the metrical psalters. Whereas the Lutheran chorale melody, in its original pristine state, specializes in eloquent, short phrases. Just think of Ein feste Burg. Eloquent, short phrases. These Genevan tunes specialize in the architecture of the whole tune. There's a continuous melody carrying on an uninterrupted musical argument, which is shaped inevitably to a climax in these tunes. Look at, for instance, page 20, Psalm 124. There's a logical continuity, phrase by phrase, in this particular melody, and one important rhetorical climax. This music was sung not with the heavy tread that came to be the style after the Reformation, but with a verve and with a flexibility that gives attention to this phrase shape. Therefore, I want us all to sing this melody, but to sing it not in the way that it was mediated to us by the dour Scotch and the old Presbyterians, but in the way that it was sung at Geneva, possibly originally. Give us our pitch, please, Mr. Pugh, and we will take it half note to the beat. And let's move everybody on the melody. Now Israel may say, and that truly, if that the Lord had not a cross made, if that the Lord had not a life sustained, where all the Lord curiously made their upwards and said he should abide. I submit to you that's a great tune. That is well integrated. That is, it moves logically and uninterruptedly to a tremendous climax, and it has great rhythmic vitality and asymmetry to it, even syncopation. Now, of course, this has been emended, and it has been debilitated in recent editions, not only by the changing of that syncopation in that third phrase, but by even taking out the third phrase altogether. And we have an adumbrated tune, which is found in some of our current hymn books. Now, we're looking at these well-wrought tunes of Bourgeois, not as they were in the original Genevan Psalter, but in the form that they were inherited by the Scottish Psalter of 1635. We're doing this because this Scottish Psalter accepted much more of the Genevan psalmody without major alteration than did the English psalters. You see, it was one thing for Louis Bourgeois to train his highly disciplined congregation in Geneva to sing these noble and expansive melodies. But it was quite another thing for the congregations of the scattered Puritan churches and meeting houses in England to assimilate these tunes, because the French language has graces which the English language simply does not possess. So that in the translation from the French into the English, something was lost musically, at least in the English psalters. The Scotch were much more adventurous musically, and they accepted the Bourgeois tunes even though it caused them many, many problems with regard to metricization. Therefore, to meet the demands of a simpler style in the English verse, the rhythms had to be smoothed out into equal length and made to conform to the more prosaic, less lyrical English ballad meter, the old 14ers, common meter we call it, 8-6-8-6, or its variations, long meter, short meter. The result was not the graceful tunes of the French, but somewhat stodgy, though strong syllabic tunes of the English, cut up into stovewood lengths, as someone has said. Just adding of stock phrases together into a common tune, often only half as long as the original that came from the continent, and therefore the origin of the short psalm tune for common meter. Now an example of a Scottish example of the short tune may be found at page 12. It's called here a French tune. It came into the English Psalters as Dundee because of its Scottish origin. Let us follow the old Calvinian and Scotch procedure, and let me line out this tune, noticing the original rhythm, and you come right after me with each phrase. Just give me a D, Mr. Pugh. Since this is unaccompanied, let's keep it in the comfortable range.
Of mercy and of judgment both.
Of mercy and of judgment both.
O Lord, my song shall be.
O Lord, my song shall be.
And it so oft as I do sing.
And it so oft as I do sing.
Shall be, O Lord, to me.
Shall be, O Lord, to thee.
Now the Scotch, at least for the first several decades of their experience with metrical psalmody, were using not so much this kind of tune as the tune that they inherited from Geneva. But alongside them, in later editions of the Scottish Psalter, there appeared the simpler tunes after the English manner, called common tunes, tunes that might be used with any psalm of the same meter. It's quite obvious that these common tunes gradually began to supplant the old proper tunes, the proper tunes being those that had been inherited from Geneva. Along with these common and proper tunes in the Scottish Psalter of 1635, which, by the way, represents the high water mark of Reformation psalmody, at least from the musical standpoint, there were tunes in reports or rapports. Look, for instance, at page 22 following. Now, this, of course, comes from the French rapporté, meaning to bring back or to turn back or to imitate. Reports may be described as tunes for four or five voices, made up in part at least by the voices entering on points of imitation, though seldom in strict fugal style, as you can see here. It has been suggested that the report of the Scottish Psalter was the ancestor of the fuguing tune, which became so popular in later New England psalmody. That has not been proved, but it's an interesting theory. The interesting thing to see about this Scotch Psalter is that though these tunes and reports were possibly primarily intended for cultivated musicians, such as the editor of this Psalter, Edward Miller, they could have been used in church with the congregation taking the church part. You see where the church part is. The actual psalm tune is down in the tenor, where it is in all of these early versions. And the choir maybe could furnish the harmonies, because the Scotch were not against harmony. They had no scruples against it, as did the Genevans. At least they didn't at this particular period, as did Calvin. And therefore, the people could take the congregational or church part, and the choir could furnish the other parts. Calvin had refused to allow part singing in Geneva, but in Scotland, singing schools, sang shulas, which were established before the Reformation, continued even after the Reformation, helping to furnish a body of educated singers in the 17th century of Scotland. And this psalter testifies to a great skill among the people themselves, as well as among those who were musicians. Notice the three kinds of tunes now that are found in the 14 that are selected here from the 150 of the Scottish Psalter. There are four common tunes. If you would look at the table of contents, you can distinguish these common tunes because they have names. There's the Culross tune, the Abbey tune, the Martyrs tune, and the French tune. There were 31 common tunes in the original Psalter. These are all to be distinguished not only because they have names, but if you will look at them, each of them, pages 5 and 6 and the others, you will see that they are all Scottish tunes, that they are all short tunes, that they all are, in fact, in common meter, 8-6-8-6. Then we have the two tunes which are in reports, Psalm 18 at page 6 and Psalm 137 at page 22. There were 8 of these psalms in this imitative fashion in the original Psalter. Then we have 8 proper tunes. Proper tunes which are known simply by the name of the psalm to which they were set. And if you will look at these, they are by far in the majority. In fact, there were 104 proper tunes in the original. These are all, nearly all, are French tunes. These are nearly all long tunes and are all known by the name to which they were sung in the Psalter. Look at the one exception to this here, and this is the famous Old Hundredth on page 11. Old Hundredth, of course, was originally to Psalm 134 in the French Genevan Psalter. It was transferred into English and set to the 100th Psalm in the Scottish Psalter to this text by William Keithy, All People That on Earth Do Dwell. It has such an enduring, hard-wearing quality that it's still the most sung tune in all the history of hymnody. And yet, we don't sing it in its original very much anymore. Here we have it in its pristine state. Let's sing it. And let's be sure we sing it exactly as written. Lengthening of the first three notes of the fourth phrase breaks what becomes a rather too regular pattern in the alterations that we have and gives a delightful asymmetry to this tune, a syncopated feeling. Now, the first alteration that was made, of course, was to smooth those out, to iron out those three notes and to make the fourth phrase exactly in the same rhythm as all the others. So that in the modern hymn books, for the most part, where you see the original version, it's not the original version, but actually the fourth phrase is in the same rhythm as the first phrase. Ta, 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 ta. And then, of course, we Baptists and others have come along and have gotten rid of the old gathering note altogether, and of even of the last three wonderful half notes as transcribed here, and we have this dull and wooden quarter note rhythm all the way through. And yet, it's such a well-constructed tune, so logically put together, that it still survives this rhythmic mutilation. And we still sing it, and I suppose shall continue to do so. Another example of what happened in more recent years with regard to some of the wonderful flexible rhythm of these original tunes, I'd like to refer in passing to a tune that's not found in the book here for just a moment, but which you will recognize immediately if you are familiar with hymn 16 in Baptist Hymnal. Some of you have Baptist hymnals in the pews there. You might want to look at it. Here is the tune as it's found in the Genevan Psalter. That's Mr. When it was brought over into the Scottish Psalter, it had to be fitted to short meter. Therefore, the Scottish Psalter divided the first phrase that you heard into two phrases. It left out the third phrase, and it elongated the last phrase with some alteration. So this is what you come out with in the Scottish Psalter. After many alterations in the 17th century, this tune dropped out of the psalters and the hymnals altogether until the 19th century, when William Crotch, in 1836, resurrected it and called it St. Michael with gathering notes. Not the tune that you see there, but rather, ta pum 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 pa pum 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 pum. And then we Baptists and others come along and finish the process by taking out the gathering notes, and we have what we call St. Michael. It's still a good tune. It still has survived all this, but it's quite interesting to see the kind of rhythmic variations that we have made upon it. Incidentally, this tune will be sung tomorrow in chapel, and we hope you will participate heartily in the singing of it. Finally, in this Psalter, let us look at Psalm 113, page 16. This is a German tune which Calvin incorporated in his very first Psalter, 1539 at Strasbourg. Matthew Greiter is probably the composer. It was taken over into the French Genevan Psalter for Marot's Psalm 36. Later it was used to Psalm 86. If you're familiar with Psalm 86, you will know that this has some passages in it that are imprecatory. And therefore certain militant stanzas of that psalm became famous as a Huguenot war song in some of their struggles in the late 16th century, so that in recent times it has been dubbed the Huguenot Marseillaise. This is the longest of all the tunes found in the old Psalters. It has 92 notes, 12 phrases. As found here, every phrase has eight, so this is 12 eights. The first three phrases you see are repeated. This gives it away as a German tune because this sets up the bar form, which is so deeply embedded in German literary and musical history. The two Stollen, and then finally starting with verse 4 as used here, we start the Abgesang. Notice that the eighth phrase repeats exactly the seventh phrase. Tum, pum, 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 pum is repeated. And then notice the imitation between the last three phrases. Starting down with verse 5. Tum, pum, 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 pum. Ta, ha, 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 ha. Let's sing it. The great Marseillaise of the Reformation.
With great fame, God, all people, the soul.
This tune was shortened from 12/8 to 6/8 and called by the tune name Lucerne, and set to John Wesley's alteration of Isaac Watts' hymn, I'll Praise My Maker. This, of course, is one of the great favorite hymns of the Methodists, being John Wesley's favorite. He tried to gasp it out even in his dying moments. And thus it's quite natural that Lloyd Faust of Southern Methodist has an arrangement which this choir is going to sing tomorrow in chapel. I'll Praise My Maker is an adaptation, of course, of old Psalm 113. I wish we could spend some more time on this, but we have this this fine laboratory choir here, and I would like for us to look in the remaining moments at the Schutz Psalter, Becker Psalter. This is an interesting example. Thank you. Continued to spread throughout Europe in the 17th century. Although the principal thrust of the Genevan psalmody was from Switzerland northward to the Low Countries and then into England, Scotland, there were strong offshoots to the south in northern Italy and to the north in Germany and in Scandinavia. We have already noted in passing how Luther based many of his hymns on the Psalms. In creating his own first hymn book for the young Lutheran church, he wrote 7 paraphrases of the Psalms, including the Aus tiefer Not, to which we referred. In this way, he made Psalms the focus of hymn composition in the earliest days of his church. In fact, the term Little Wittenberg Psalms was used to describe the entire field of evangelical church song, despite many translations and paraphrases which may have been not from the Psalms, but from other songs, other hymns, and even from the Mass, as Dr. Husted mentioned this morning. Similarly, for the Netherlands, there were the Suderliedekens, the little psalm songs in Dutch, which were set to already existing folk tunes. These were set in harmony, of course, by many outstanding composers, including Clemens Non Papa, among others. But of greater significance for Germany was the German translation of the Huguenot Psalter by Ambrose Lobwasser in 1573. This was a translation into the German of strict metrical versions, which became the central hymn book of the Reformed Church in Germany. Many of these were sung to French tunes, by the way, originally. In opposition, however, to the Calvinistic Lobwasser, there arose a Lutheran rivalry on the part of the rather dry Leipzig theology professor by the name of Cornelius Becker, who supplemented the 7 original Psalms of Luther with 143 of his own and published his complete collection of German versified Psalms in 1602. Inasmuch as the Becker strophes did not show too great a diversity of metrical form, a phenomenon not unlike that which happened in England, it was easy for the evangelicals to use the Becker's text with existing chorale melodies. And so this German collection, set to German tunes, was popularly known as the Becker Psalter. Now Heinrich Schütz, the great German contemporary of Monteverdi, comes along in 1628, and while appropriating some of the 13 melodies already in existence, he composed 90 new melodies and placed them in 4-part settings, which in view of his soaring imagination and creativity are models of self-imposed restraint. This is the simplest music that I know of that Heinrich Schütz ever wrote. Thus we have the so-called Becker Psalter of Heinrich Schütz, 1628, 10 examples of which are provided here in this English edition by Robert Wunderlich. The last piece, by the way, in here is a responsorium, not a psalm, but this was printed at the very end of the collection and could well serve, I might suggest, as a good call to worship. Now let's look at some of the details here. All of the texts in this Concordia publication are translated from Becker's German version, except Psalm 12, page 4. Psalm 12 is one of Martin Luther's original 7, as you can see from the notation at the bottom. Also, all of the melodies here are those newly composed by Schutz except that of Psalm 12, which was one of the very first chorale melodies being published originally in 1524 in the Erfurter in Carinthian. Two characteristics are immediately apparent in these Psalms of Schutz. First of all, the bar form, which is embedded, as I said, so deeply in the German literary and musical history and is very predominant in these Psalms of Schutz. Look at Psalm 6, for instance, page, the very first one, in which the music for the third and fourth phrases is exactly the music of the first and second phrases. There's the Tustallen, and then we go down to the word, to the phrases, for I am weak, my strength is vain, for the Abgesang. This can be seen in 12, the one we were just looking at, on page 4. This is also in bar form. Psalm 84, page 8, which the choir is going to sing in just a minute, is bar form. Also, Psalm 97, page 9, is bar form. And the longer setting, Psalm 117, is bar form, as is quite apparent from the fact that in the addition, it's simply repeated. The other thing to notice about these psalms is that although many of them follow a fairly strict syllabic rule, for instance, Psalm 66, page 7, most of them, however, are more in the German tradition, giving an occasional two, three, or more notes to a syllable. Thus, the monotony of one note to a syllable is artfully broken with modest melismata. Example, look at Psalm 100 of Schutz, page 11. Here you have basically a syllabic setting, and yet look at the word land. Make a joyful noise unto the Lord in every land. Just of three notes, but it breaks the syllabic rule. And then more importantly, look on down at the last phrase, come to his presence with a song. Very modest, but certainly not what you found in Bourgeois. It will be interesting, in fact, to compare Schutz with Bourgeois in their settings of Psalm 100. Page 11 in both collections. What a coincidence. Bourgeois Psalm 100 and Schutz Psalm 100, page 11 in the English editions. First of all, we've already noted that the Bourgeois tune is strictly syllabic as compared with Schutz, with its melodic movement on the words land and presence in the first stanza. Notice in the second place the similarity of meter. Both of these are in long meter, which shows that Becker was greatly influenced by Marot and de Beza and the others who metricized the French Psalter, and that we have the 8-8-8-8 for this particular song. In the third place, notice that the Schutz melody starts and stops in D, but it starts on the upper final, the high D, and it descends gradually to the lower final. Also, the highest point of the Schutz melody is in the second phrase. So that if you were to graph this melody, you find he starts high and then he gradually relaxes over the entire course of the melody to the point of rest at the lower final. Now look at Bourgeois. We all know the melody very well, but did we ever notice the fact that it starts and stops on the same final and that it does not get to its high point, its climax, until the final phrase, before coming to rest suddenly at the same point from which it started? So that the Bourgeois melody, and this is quite characteristic of the Genevan tunes, they start logically, continuously, a continuous argument to that one important rhetorical point, and then usually drop right off after it's being there in either the ultimate or the penultimate phrase. Now, Bourgeois got jailed for setting his tunes in parts. Therefore, this is not Bourgeois setting here, of course. It's a Scottish setting. And it's of course of later vintage, but it does reveal some points of the current style. Note the suspensions now. By the way, Mr. Pugh, there was one other thing I wanted you to do. I'm sorry. I would like for you just to play this harmonization now without our singing. Notice the 4-3 suspensions in measure 3, in measure 11, and the 7-6-4-3 in measure 12. A delightful use of dissonance, which we do not find today. And of course, with the tune embedded down in the tenor, the whole structure of the harmonization takes on a different flavor. Shift to the major chord on the subtonic in measure 5. You hear it? It sort of jolts you, doesn't it? This avoids the weakening effect of the diminished chord, which would result if the leading tone were used there. This sudden use of the F when the F sharp has been sounding, of course, reflects the modal flavor of these harmonies. Another example is found in measure 11, where you have C sharp in close juxtaposition to C. This is somewhat typical of the harmonic progressions of the time. But above all, note the logical, clear, and consistent harmonic pattern of the four phrases of this tune. It cadences in G on the first phrase. It cadences in D, the dominant, on the second phrase. It cadences in G on the third phrase, and in G on the fourth. The final chord is in open fifths, and this, of course, is typical. Now, by contrast, Schütz achieves a greater harmonic variety and interest, not by suspensions so much, as by his characteristic colorful shift to various tonal levels. Notice his first phrase. It starts in D, but he goes to G immediately, and finally ending on B, which is dominant of E. Feeling actually, if you hear this, do you have it now, mister?
Yes.
Would you mind playing it for us? The second phrase starts in B, it immediately goes to G at the beginning of the second score, but ends in A, which is the dominant of the final, D. Listen to the second phrase. Then the third, there's a shift of an A to an A sharp, and you have F sharp, the dominant of B minor. We get the B minor in the third phrase, do we not? Subtonic again, just like we saw in the other harmonization. C, back to E, and finally coming back to the D final. Open fifths at the phrase endings. Wunderlich says you must fill in those in performance, but I don't know whether that's necessarily so or not. Dr. Husted, would you mind having the choir sing that for us right now? That's all right. This is demonstration. It is understood that the choir has not really had much time to rehearse this. May I say while Mr. Davidson is coming that, of course, Schütz had no scruples against harmony or counterpoint and would have intended that this be sung in four parts with accompaniment. Sometime subsequent to the second edition of this, he wrote out, in fact, a thorough bass part. And as Wunderlich says, we could very easily have a bassoon or a cello playing along on the thorough bass in good Baroque style. We don't have the bass, but we will do it as here.
Thank you.
maybe should explain that we have countertenors in this choir.
Yes, that's right.
And they have to struggle a bit on this one. We hadn't also sung this before.
Thank you.
Can we try another stanza?
Surely.
All right. Number two, The Lord is God. Origin.
This is very simple music when compared with Schutz's other works, such as the Sacred Symphonies, the Cantiones Sacra. These psalms would clearly be of best use with a choral group, but they're easily within the grasp of a small choir of average abilities and meager resources, as well as larger, more accomplished ones, and I think they highly commend themselves for this use. Look at the form. I think we have time to look at least one more. Look at Psalm 84. How lovely is thy dwelling? Page 8. This again is bar form, as we have already noticed. It's highly modulatory and chromatic in movement. Notice establishment of B flat, but before we're through with the first short phrase, we're in G minor. And then all of a sudden we're in C and modulate back into A. All of that is repeated at the obgesang. We have B flat going to a feeling of F, the dominant F in C, and then ending with going with C to a G dominant of D, and finally working back to the original D. In contrast to the dactylic beginnings of the Genevan Psalms, ta, 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 which is almost uniform throughout all of this. This, of course, is characteristic of the chanson and the canzonas of the Renaissance. There, here we have a triple beat with iambic meter. Ta, 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 ta. This triple rhythmic movement is not interrupted by Schutz until the end, but then it's very effectively done by the slightly florid movement on the word God in the very last phrase, the first stanza. Could we have the choir to sing this one? And by the way, this is one that we're going to be using in worship tomorrow.
Within thy voice to me, my heart.
wish we had time to listen to some more of these. This has been but a brief and inadequate introduction to a vast reservoir of psalmic material that can be tapped for the purposes of reinstating this great body of devotional material to our public worship. In the great paraphrases by Watts, by Montgomery, by Light, as well as the best from the old Psalters, we have preserved the spirit as well as the letter of the Psalms in English meter. Moreover, we have as a rich part of our musical heritage these archetypal tunes of the Genevan Psalter mediated to us largely through the Scottish Psalter. Sturdy, well-wrought melodies that set a noble standard for all subsequent hymn tunes. For congregational singing, this glorious hymn music was originally conceived. The best of it needs to be resurrected for today's congregational singing. And more of our contemporary hymnal editors are recognizing this fact. If you'll look at the new Methodist hymnal, if you'll look at the hymn book of the Presbyterian Church, if you'll look at the Pilgrim hymnal, if you'll look at this little publication, Christian Hymns, by the World Publishing Company, you will find that more and more of these wonderful tunes as well as texts from this great tradition are coming back into the singing of our people, at least if we can judge from the content of contemporary hymn books. Only 118 hymns here. There are 9 of the Genevan melodies here, some of them used more than once. Furthermore, in the fine harmonizations of these tunes, which we did not have time to discuss at all, such as those by Claude Gudamel, Claude Lejeune, as well as these tunes and reports, which we saw from the Scottish Psalter, we have settings, including German settings, such as those of Schütz, which have a wealth of excellent material for choral worship. Not difficult, but excellent for use. Let's see if the metrical psalm does not offer us one viable form for restoring the psalms to our musical worship. Thank you.